Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. European Union Justice and Interior Ministers wrestled Monday to overcome divisions in dealing with the thousands of migrants and refugees flooding into their countries as several nations imposed border controls to handle the crisis. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
The ministers are at odds over the proposal by the EU's executive arm to impose mandatory distribution quotas for asylum seekers from Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, who have overwhelmed three frontline states in particular, Greece, Hungary, and Italy. Arriving at the Brussels talks, Slovak Interior Minister Robert Kalinak said the march of migrants through Europe in recent days shows quotas don't work.
We think that quotas is not the solution. First step, how to stop that flow and how to help the people which are still on the camps in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon.
Germany and Sweden accepted the EU's highest number of asylum seekers last year. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Egyptian officials say a group of tourists was in a restricted area when security forces opened fire Sunday, mistaking the group for suspected terrorists and killing at least 12 people, including two Mexican citizens. Egypt's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said Monday that military and police forces were targeting terrorists, utilizing 4x4 vehicles similar to those being used by the tourists when they fired on the visitors Sunday in Farafra, part of Egypt's western desert. Six survivors told Mexico's ambassador to Egypt that their convoy was attacked by both plane and helicopter. This is VOA News. Taliban insurgents have stormed a prison in eastern Afghanistan, releasing hundreds of prisoners. The well-organized attack began with a suicide car bombing that allowed other rebels to get into the prison, said Mohammad Ali Ahmadi, deputy provincial governor of the eastern Ghazni province. Afghan officials say there were a total of 436 prisoners in the complex, of which 355 escaped during the attack. The government said 148 of the escapees were threats to national security. A U.S. courthouse clerk who was jailed for refusing to issue same-sex marriage licenses returned to work Monday, saying she would not block her deputies from issuing them, but then questioned the document's validity without her authorization. Kim Davis showed up at the Rowan County Courthouse in Kentucky after being jailed for 5 days. Federal court judge held her in contempt and put her behind bars after she defied his order to issue the licenses. Davis, an apostolic Christian, says gay marriage violates her religious beliefs. A reform panel established in the wake of a black teen's shooting death by a white police officer last year in Missouri on Monday released the results of the 10-month review into racially inequalities the state faces. Among the 189 calls to action is the recommendation to consolidate the police agencies and courts in and around St. Louis, including Ferguson, where Officer Darren Wilson fatally shot unarmed Michael Brown during an August 2014 confrontation. Federal investigation found systemic discrimination by the Ferguson police force, and the grand jury decision not to indict Wilson sparked massive protests in the area and around the United States. The governor of Japan's southern island of Okinawa says he will revoke permits for the construction of a new U.S. airbase on his island after talks broke down between his administration and officials in Tokyo. Takashi Onaga told reporters Monday that his government was taking the action after discovering defects in the original permits issued by his predecessor. His decision was announced just days after work resumed at the site near a remote coastal village on Okinawa called Hinoko. Onaga was elected governor last year on a pledge to block the relocation of the U.S. Marine Corps Air Base from a heavily populated area of Okinawa to Hinoko and instead move the facility to another island. Billionaire Donald Trump continues to gain support in his quest to be the Republican candidate in next year's U.S. presidential election. In a new Washington Post ABC News poll released Monday, 33% of Republican voters said they would choose him. That is up from 24% who said they would support him in July. The rest of the crowd, Republican field, is struggling to keep pace. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In the immediate term, to maintain the search and rescue operations so that people are not drowning in the Mediterranean, but also to provide safe and legal routes to Europe to prevent some of the smuggling and the trafficking that you're seeing. And as people are moving through, we're calling on reception and support facilities that are tailored for children, that meet their needs.
That's Francine Uenuma of Save the Children calling for action to deal with the migrant and refugee crisis. We'll have details on this story coming up. Also in the news, Mexico demands an investigation of the deaths of Mexican tourists killed by Egyptian troops this morning. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari begins meetings with French President Francois Hollande today. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Kenya, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, European Union ministers wrestle today to overcome deep divisions over how to deal with the thousands of migrants and refugees flooding into their countries as several nations imposed border controls to handle the crisis. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The ministers are at odds over the proposal by the EU's executive arm to impose mandatory distribution quotas for asylum seekers from Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, who have overwhelmed three frontline states in particular, Greece, Hungary, and Italy. Arriving at the Brussels talks, Slovak Interior Minister Robert Kalinak said the march of migrants through Europe in recent days shows quotas don't work.
We think that quotas is not the solution. First step, how to stop that flow and how to help the people which are still on the camps in Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon.
Slovakia is among several Central and Eastern EU states that oppose quotas. Another country that opposes quotas is Hungary, which threatens to tighten its much-criticized crackdown against incoming migrants as of Tuesday. Many of the migrants and refugees are headed for Germany and Sweden. Many come from conflict-torn nations like Syria, Iraq, and Somalia. Their mounting numbers prompted Germany, Slovakia, and Austria to establish controls, temporarily suspending the Schengen open border system. Swedish Justice and Migration Minister Morgan Johansson said Europe has the means to welcome them all. Sweden is among several EU members, including Germany, that support mandatory refugee quotas. Germany now says it may receive 1 million migrants this year, 200,000 more than previously estimated. Germany and Sweden accepted the EU's highest number of asylum seekers last year. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Save the Children is one of the organizations helping the migrants and refugees flooding into Europe. Francine Uenuma is a spokesperson for the NGO's crisis response team in Greece. From the island of Lesbos, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the daily arrivals of refugees and migrants.
It's very fluid. People arrived yesterday. As we were driving, we saw a dinghy coming in, and my colleagues were there, saw about nine more come in just over an hour. So it's very unpredictable. And yesterday, actually on this boat, there was a woman who was injured and a couple babies that we ended up driving down to get them into town for medical care, because a lot of the refugees that come in will walk up to 70 kilometers to get from the north of the island to where they can register and then move on to Athens. So it's a really long journey, and people have to take all these different steps, and they have to walk, and you have people injured, and you have a lot of children. Even on the island, you see people walking on the road all the time.
This influx has been going on a while now through Greece. Has your organization and others been able to come up with a system that can cope with it on a regular basis?
Well, it's difficult because the population is really transient. There are a couple areas where people have informal camps that we've gone to, and we've done distributions to try to provide some basic food items, diapers, things of that nature. But what you see is people coming in and, if they can, leaving fairly quickly. So we're trying to meet the needs of a population that comes and they go quickly. For us, it's a holistic thing because we're working you know, in the Middle East, in the Syria region, but also in other parts of Europe to try to reach children that are really vulnerable along the way. They're often sleeping out in the open and at risk for exploitation and a variety of harms. So it's something where we're trying to be as flexible as we can, because if you look on a map, they're covering a tremendous amount of ground as they try to move through Europe.
Certainly the recent photo of the dead Syrian child focused the world attention even more on the crisis. What are you seeing regarding kids coming into Greece? What kind of condition are they in?
A lot of them are very young. Certainly it's a challenge both for their physical health, to be walking and to be exposed to the elements. You know, for example, one of the babies that arrived on the dinghy yesterday was very, very cold, but also they're very frightened. I mean, they've seen so much often in their country of origin before they even left. Those children who've come from Syria have repeatedly described to us experiencing violence or having their school attacked. But also, as they move through, one child told us of being imprisoned along the way with his parents and gestured to us that a gun had been pointed at his father's head. So it's really a physical and an emotional toll for children who are having to leave home, home being what it was, again, having had their lives fall apart there, and then be on this really, really dangerous journey.
Once the migrants and refugees leave Lesbos, where you are, where do they go?
So many have gone up to Athens on a ferry to then try to get up to the north and cross the border. Some are paying for tickets to get, it's about an 11 or 12 hour ferry ride. So again, it's a very long way. They come in and often walk for a couple days to even get to Mytilene, the town where the ferry leaves. And then most will try to then go on to Athens to be able to cross the border and continue on north.
What would Save the Children like to see to help resolve this crisis?
Well, it's a complicated crisis, and the answers are not easy or simple, but there are several steps that we've called for that can make a concrete and tangible difference. And one is, of course, in the immediate term, to maintain the search and rescue operations so that people are not drowning in the Mediterranean, but also to provide safe and legal routes to Europe to prevent some of the smuggling and the trafficking that you're seeing. And as people are moving through, we're calling on reception and support facilities that are tailored for children, that meet their needs, including some of the unaccompanied minors, and of course, to be able to resettle in a way in Europe that shares the burden. Again, it's not an easy solution and it won't happen overnight, but these steps have to start now. It's already at a crisis point.
Now, the European ministers are meeting to try to resolve a crisis, and the number they're looking at is 160,000 or so to try to resettle. But the actual number of people who've come to Europe is much greater than that. Do you fear that the solution will always be a step behind the problem?
We've seen for the last several years that the solutions have been a step behind the problem. Many are still in the region, but more than 4 million people have left Syria alone. And that's not counting those who are coming through Greece, who are from Afghanistan or who are from Iraq. So unfortunately, there's been a lot of inaction up to this point in addressing this crisis and the crises that are contributing to this. So again, it's an important step to scale that up and to start addressing it. But, you know, the time for action has been several years now, so we really want to see that scaled up.
Francine Uenouma is a spokesperson for Save the Children's Crisis Response Team in Greece. From the island of Lesbos, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Well, the world's focus is on the refugee and migrant crisis in Europe, but millions of people are also on the move across Africa, escaping poverty and persecution. As Henry Ridgewell reports, migration experts say the global networks are linked, and any solution must address the causes of the upheaval at its source.
Corralled by armed smugglers, dozens of migrants from across West Africa line up to board a pickup truck in the city of Agadez, Niger. They're heading for Libya, from where they hope to get on a boat across the Mediterranean. It's not an easy journey. Senegalese migrant Ousmane Sonko was captured by Libyan authorities earlier this year and deported back to Dakar. He says the Libyan authorities caught them at sea and took them to a prison in very bad conditions. We were sleeping on the ground, he says. The conditions there aren't good for a human being. The world's attention is focused on the hundreds of thousands of refugees and economic migrants arriving on Europe's shores. But that is just a snapshot of a global crisis, says Amnesty International's Gauri van Gulik.
Europe is facing a crisis of how it's responding to refugees. It's not facing a refugee crisis. I mean, globally, there are 19.5 million refugees right now.
With so many people on the move, the search for a solution should focus on the source of upheaval, whether it's conflicts in the Middle East or poverty and persecution in Africa, says Michel Bombassé, West Africa specialist at the International Organization for Migration.
What's happening right now in the Mediterranean is just the last step of a long, long process that in many cases started here in West Africa.
The majority of migrants in Africa stay on the continent, but moving around is getting harder amid concerns over the economy and security. In South Africa, migrants fled an outbreak of xenophobic attacks this year by residents afraid of foreigners taking their jobs. Cameroon, Niger and Chad have deported thousands of Nigerians following attacks by the Islamist terror group Boko Haram. Again, Michel Bombassé.
In very specific areas, the presence of large numbers of sometimes of migrants, sometimes undocumented, is a concern for many governments, especially with the risk of infiltration of terrorists or armed groups of different kinds.
European and African leaders are due to attend a summit in November aimed at dealing with the migrant crisis. Experts say any solution must address the lack of economic opportunities in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thank you, Henry. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, condemns the failure of the international community to act to protect the hundreds of thousands of Syrians and refugees from other countries seeking asylum from war and persecution in Europe. The High Commissioner has opened the UN Human Rights Council's three-week session on a particularly somber note. Lisa Schlein reports from the Council in Geneva.
The High Commissioner lambasted the hypocrisy of a world that professes to uphold and protect the human rights of the most vulnerable by invoking the tragic and heart-rending image of Aylin al-Kurdi. This is the little boy whose lifeless body was swept ashore in Turkey while trying to escape to Europe from the violence in Syria.
It made us choke. Shamed and disgraced, the world wept before the body of this little boy. These speeches, these sessions, these protests by so many of us here for a world more humane and more dignifying of the rights of all humans, what good are they when this happens?
High Commissioner Zayed Raad al-Hussein commended Jordan, Lebanon and Turkey in the Middle East and Germany and Sweden in Europe for hosting refugees and migrants needing protection. He thanked the millions of ordinary people who opened their homes. He denounced what he called the mean-spiritedness of some decision makers for whipping up xenophobic hatred among their populations. He welcomed a European Union proposal to relocate 120,000 refugees in member states and urged Europe to build on this surge of human feeling.
We need expanded channels of regular migration and resettlement, two measures which would prevent deaths and cut smuggling. Detention, particularly of children, and all forms of ill treatment should cease at borders and elsewhere.
The High Commissioner noted that all regions of the world are guilty of atrocities and gross human rights violations. He said too many countries in Africa, in Asia, in the Middle East, in the Americas are getting away with crimes against their people because no one is being held accountable. In regard to sub-Saharan Africa, he expressed particular concern about conditions in seven countries: Central African Republic, Sudan, South Sudan, Somalia, Mali, Eritrea and Burundi. While the circumstances differed, he noted violent and unconscionable actions in all these countries have resulted in countless thousands of deaths and injuries and millions of people being internally displaced or as refugees. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 20 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. EU ministers wrestle today to overcome deep divisions over how to deal with the thousands of migrants and refugees flooding into their countries. And Mexico demands an investigation of the deaths of Mexican tourists killed by Egyptian troops this morning. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. Visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. Well, Mexico is demanding an investigation of the deaths of Mexican tourists killed by Egyptian troops this morning. The incident occurred in the western desert. At least 12 tourists died and 10 were injured when their convoy of civilian vehicles was fired upon. The vehicles were stopped for a barbecue near the Bajaria Oasis. A military spokesman said the victims were Mexican and Egyptian. Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has condemned the incident. Egypt's Interior Ministry says security forces mistakenly fired on the vans while pursuing terrorists in the area. The Egyptian Tourism Office says the tourists were traveling in a restricted area and had not requested permission. The camping safari was organized by a local hotel. Well, overcrowded conditions along with the rainy season have prompted two cholera vaccination campaigns in South Sudan. The health teams from the International Organization for Migration, IOM, and their partners conducted a two-round oral cholera vaccination campaign, as well as a single-dose vaccination campaign for thousands of internally displaced persons. The campaign began in late August and continued through early September. Haley West is an IOM health program manager. She spoke with me about their latest cholera vaccination campaigns.
IOM conducted the oral cholera vaccination campaign in both the Bentiu Protection of Civilian Site, which is in Unity State, as well as we were the lead for the oral cholera vaccination campaign in Malakal Protection of Civilian Site, which is in Upper Nile State in South Sudan.
How many people were involved in these campaigns in terms of receiving the vaccinations?
In terms of receiving the vaccination, in total, the number of people that we say that benefited was 113,600 internally displaced persons, and that's in both camps.
What is their present health condition?
The internally displaced people who are living in both Bentiu and Malakal POC face a number of environmental challenges in terms of things that may affect their health. When we look at prevention, we want to look at ensuring that they have access to clean water and that they have access to proper spacing of shelters, that they have access to preventative measures such as mosquito nets. Here in South Sudan, malaria is endemic, and we have particularly one of the worst types or strains of malaria. We have P. falciparum, and right now, most of the population is being affected by higher rates of malaria in both of those two sites because it is the rainy season, which means more stagnant water around the homes, which means that it's a breeding ground for mosquitoes, which are the vectors for malaria.
During times like this, how are the most vulnerable people, the children, the elderly, the babies, pregnant women, how are they faring in these types of conditions?
I think humanitarians for sure focus on the vulnerable individuals within the site. As health partners, we work with other clusters, the protection cluster, the WASH cluster, to ensure that those who are more vulnerable have access and that we go out of our way to be proactive in reaching elderly people who may not be able to leave their shelters to seek care at the health facility. So there's a whole range of interventions that are in place, including health promotion, where we have outreach workers that go out into the community spreading key messages about how to keep yourself safe from direwolves diseases or malaria, any waterborne disease, for instance. So that's one of the ways that we reach out to some of the community members who might not be able to come to the health facility. And there's a referral process as well for that. For small children, we really focus on the women in the families. They are the sort of foundation of the health and access to education and these types of things. We focus on making sure that they are aware of the services that are available and that they receive the services for the children, that they are encouraged to come for routine vaccinations for measles and polio, particularly for the oral cholera vaccinations, the social mobilization that happens to ensure that the mothers in the family understood the importance of this as a critical preventative tool that we have in our tool bag as health practitioners and public health advocates. But that, at the same time, it's not the cure-all for all diarrheal diseases. The oral vaccination for cholera is specifically for cholera, so we have to make sure that they still understand good sanitation and hygiene practices, and that, you know, these soft components, the behavior change, is oftentimes the most critical but the hardest to get the community to accept sometimes.
So given this is a process of continuing to educate the families.
Correct. I would say sensitization of the families, specifically the women and the youth. I would say the youth play a really important role as well. In many of these sites, you know, they are looking for something to contribute to, and they've been a really important factor in our own outreach, engaging the youth, not only to spread the messages among themselves, but also to reach out to other parts of the community.
That was Haley West, an IOM Health Program Manager. She spoke with me from Juba, South Sudan. While Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari began meeting with French President Francois Hollande today, they're expected to discuss military efforts to contain Nigeria's Boko Haram Islamist insurgency. An advisor to Mr. Buhari has told VOA the president was invited to Paris for 3 days of talks on strengthening relations between the two countries. A major issue is improving cooperation between Nigeria and several French-speaking neighboring countries that are coordinating efforts to defeat the militants. In related news, 9 people died and 24 people were wounded in neighboring Cameroon when 2 bombs exploded yesterday in the town of Kolofata. The town is near the Nigerian border and has been attacked repeatedly by Boko Haram fighters. Cameroon is a military partner in the regional effort to defeat Boko Haram. And in Nigeria's Plateau State, at least 4 students died and 14 were injured as their 2-story Islamic school collapsed yesterday. Local sources say the incident is due to poor construction and not the Boko Haram violence. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. EU ministers wrestle today to overcome deep divisions over how to deal with the thousands of migrants and refugees flooding into their countries. Mexico demands an investigation of the deaths of Mexican tourists killed by Egyptian troops this morning. And Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari began meetings with French President Francois Hollande today. Coming up, we'll have music from Kenya, and in our feature segment, in Zimbabwe, gains made during the unity government of President Robert Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai are being eroded fast. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some kudos for the two U.S. Open tennis champions.
Kim, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Novak Djokovic and Flavia Panetta, who won the men's and women's singles titles over the weekend at the U.S. Open tennis tournament in New York City. Ladies first in an all-Italian women's final. The 33-year-old Panetta defeated her childhood friend Roberta Vinci in straight sets 7-6 and 6-2. Vinci had upset world number one Serena Williams in three sets in the semifinals, crushing the hopes of Serena winning a calendar year Grand Slam. That is, all four major tournaments in 2015. Before accepting the trophy and $3.3 million for her first Grand Slam title, the greatest triumph of her career, Panetta announced her retirement.
I feel really happy. I mean, I'm really ready for this kind of life, for change my life, and I couldn't think to do in a better way.
Meanwhile, Novak Djokovic lifted the men's trophy in New York after beating Swiss star Roger Federer in four sets Sunday night. The final score, 6-4, 5-7, 6-4, and 6-4. It was the second U.S. Open title for Djokovic. The world's top-ranked player also won in 2011. And Djokovic moved into double digits with his 10th Grand Slam title overall.
We got to double digits now, and this is, you know, I'm so flattered and honored to be a part of a elite group of players and legends of our sport that managed to win this many Grand Slam trophies in their lives and in their careers. So to be just mentioned alongside them, it's truly something special.
It's truly been a special year for Novak Djokovic. The Serbian star reached the final of all four Grand Slam tournaments, and he won three of them. The Australian Open, Wimbledon, and now the U.S. Open. Italian tennis player Flavia Panetta wasn't the only sports champion to announce their retirement over the weekend. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman Shagun Dot on the spot Adeyemi reports.
American Floyd Mayweather Jr. has retired from boxing after beating Haitian American Andre Beto. In a unanimous decision on Saturday night, the victory also ensured that Mayweather quit the stage on a clean note, tying the unbeaten 49-0 record of another American, Rocky Marciano. After the fight, Mayweather said,
"You know, I face all the top guys in the sport of boxing. You know, to be in a sport for 19 years and to be world champion 18 years, I had a remarkable career."
Mayweather got a paycheck of $32 million US dollars for the fight. He made $250 million in May when he defeated Filipino Manny Pacquiao in what was billed as the fight of the year. Overall, Mayweather, who is 38 years old, has made $700 million in his career.
You get to a certain level to where you can't buy nothing anymore. You know, you can't get moved by a Rolls Royce, or you can't get moved by a car. When you got everything, there's nothing else you can get moved by. And I've accomplished everything in the sport. So now it's time for me to help these young fighters break my record. I want to see my records broken. Of course, I want to be a part of it. I'm just blessed.
Undefeated American boxing star Floyd Mayweather, who says he's hanging up the gloves for good. And thanks to Shagun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi for that report. Shagun also has some African club football news for us.
All the four semifinalists have now emerged in the 2015 African Champions League after the conclusion of day six matches. The semifinalists are four-time champion TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Al Hilal of Sudan in Group A, as well as USM Alger of Algeria and Almerek of Sudan in Group B. On Saturday, TP Mazembe beat Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco 5-0 in their final Group A match to finish on top of the group with 11 points. For its part, Al Hilal drew 1-1 with Smouha of Egypt to finish second on 9 points. In Group B, Almerek defeated USM Alger by a lone goal to finish in second place on 13 points. Despite the defeat, the Algerian club finished on top of the group on 15 points. The semi-finals will be played over two legs, with the first leg slated for the weekend of September 25th to 27th, and the return leg for the weekend of October 2nd to 4th. In the last four, Almerek will take on TP Mazembe, while Al Hilal will go against USM Alger. Turning to Africa's second-tier club football competition, the CAF Confederation Cup, all the four semi-finalists have also emerged. They are defending champion Al Ahly of Egypt and Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia in Group A, and Zamalek of Egypt and Orlando Pirates of South Africa in Group B. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station, of course, with partner, that UA. VOA. And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to sports radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
African athletes won international races all over the world this past weekend. In this report, Mark Ouma focuses on action in Congo Brazzaville, Italy, and Belgium.
Tunisian Habiba Gribi clocked a 9 minutes and 5.36 seconds in 3,000 meter steeplechase, and Kenyan Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon ran 4 minutes and 16.71 seconds in 1 mile as each set an Africa women's record at the IWF Diamond League in Brussels, Belgium. Botswana's Nigel Amos, Ethiopian Yomif Kejelcha, and Kenyan Virginia Nyambura won the Diamond League trophy in the men's 800 meters, 5,000 meters, and women's 3,000 meter steeplechase, respectively. The trophy represents the highest points accumulated in an event during the Diamond League Series. In Italy, Burundi's Francine Nyonsaba won women's 800 meters in 1 minute and 57.62 seconds at the IWF World Challenge meet in Rieti on Sunday. Ethiopian Gudef Tsegay and Algerian Taufik Makloufi won women's and men's 1500 meters respectively. Moroccan Brahim Talib, Kenyan Hilary Mayo, and Jonathan Drake of Mauritius triumphed in 3000 meters steeplechase, 3000 meters and triple jump respectively. In the Republic of Congo, Margaret Chelimo led Rosemary Wanjiru and Alice Aporote in a 1-2-3 Kenyan triumph in women's 5000 meters at the All Africa Games in Brazzaville on Sunday. Clement Kemboi and Hilary Kemboi secured a 1-2 Kenyan victory in men's 3000 meters steeplechase as Ethiopian Mamare Haile Mariam placed third. Cameroon's Jolie Mbumi won women's triple jump with Nigerian Ibrahim Blessing and Ghana's Nadia Eke second and third respectively. South African Russell Tucker won men's discus. Eso Hunamundam Chalim was second in Togo national record of 52.72 meters, and Republic of Congo's Frank Elembe placed third.
The Sunny Side of Sports remembers Hall of Fame basketball player Moses Malone, who died Sunday at age 60. Nicknamed Chairman of the Boards, Moses Malone was a relentless rebounder, a three-time NBA Most Valuable Player, and a 12-time NBA All-Star. He went straight from Petersburg High School in Virginia to a 21-year professional basketball career in 1983, teaming up with fellow Hall of Famer Julius Dr. J. Irving. Malone and the Philadelphia 76ers won the NBA championship. Moses also played for seven other NBA clubs, as well as the Utah Stars and Spirits of St. Louis in the now defunct American Basketball Association. In 1996, 1 year after he retired, Moses was named one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history. Hall of Fame basketball player Moses Malone, dead at the age of 60. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. I got a tweet from my friend Austin Okan Akpan in Lagos, Nigeria. Austin says he missed me last week on the Sports Tonight Show on Nigeria's channels television. I usually drop in via Skype on Thursday evenings and send sporty greetings to Austin and all of his many Sports Tonight viewers, but I was feeling a bit under the weather last Thursday, and I promised to make it up to Austin this week. In response, Austin says, "Let's make it rock, Sonny." You got it, Austin. In the meantime, buddy, keep talking sports. Yes, sir. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up in Zimbabwe, gains made during the unity government of President Robert Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai are being eroded fast. And next, Tanzanian chemical engineers' innovative filter to purify water. But first, some music. Here is Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa Higher Higher.
priceless. Put yourself upon its throne. Hey, yeah, yeah. 20 years for power.
What?
30 plus and 14 more.
30 plus and 14 more.
All the worries that my family and my friends, their family.
Deborah Debs of Cameroon with Africa, Higher, Higher.
Well, the crisis in Zimbabwe's coalition says gains made during the unity government of President Robert Mugabe and Morgan Tsvangirai are being eroded fast as Harare struggles to get a grip on the economy. From Harare, reporter Patricia Mudadigwa has the story.
Speaking at the launch of the coalition's first edition of the ZimGov Barometer, which tracks the performance of the government's implementation of policies that enhance democratic and economic progress, researcher Tulani Muskelando said many of the gains recorded during the unit government are being eroded by the country's stagnation.
We have come to the conclusion that Zimbabwe has restored the progress. In fact, we are facing possibilities that we might regress, we might backslide.
The report, which focuses on public accountability, constitutionalism, electoral reforms, and the economy, says flawed elections and lack of democratic reforms can be blamed for Zimbabwe's current situation. The coalition says the government should urgently align the country's laws with the new constitution.
Then we have also been looking at issues of constitutionalism, where we have said that there is no political will to implement the constitution.
Commenting on the crisis in Zimbabwe coalition report, economist Farai Maveza said, for him, Zimbabwe is not stagnant, but regressing.
I find it surprising that they say Zimbabwe is still stagnant, because I thought we were actually going backwards. But they have the data, so maybe they know what they're saying. But on the ground, if you look at what we have experienced, it seems that we are moving backwards and not stagnating.
Former Economic Planning and Investment Promotion Minister and the Inclusive Government, Tapuwa Mashakada, likened the economy to a frozen corpse, adding there's an urgent need for fresh capital to be injected into the economy.
If you look at all fundamentals, from growth, deflation, unemployment, poverty, infrastructural decay, and corruption, those are telltale signs of a moribund economy, which is very difficult to resuscitate.
Crisis in Zimbabwe coalition said it is currently in the process of producing what it says is an alternative economic blueprint to Zuma Asset, the government's economic blueprint, which they say has failed to deliver. Theirs will be called Zim Smart and will provide possible solution to the country's economic problems, according to the coalition. In Harare, I'm Patricia Mdadigwa.
A Tanzanian chemical engineer has designed an innovative water filter using nanotechnology to purify water. Dr. Askwa Kilongwa says his filter can remove up to 99% of bacteria, microorganisms, and contaminants. Reporter Linog Mudu has the story.
This is clean, safe drinking water.
Tanzanian scientist Dr. Askwa Hilonga says the water filter he has created is very effective. The new invention is now helping a section of Tanzanians get clean water. Catherine Nyanyaro is a housewife and lives in Arusha. She says the filter is also helping her save time.
Before I had this filter, I used to fetch water from the river. And sometimes I used it without boiling it because it is very time-consuming to boil the water. I had many problems, like typhoid and other diseases, from the water.
The filter is tailored to absorb anything from copper and fluoride to bacteria and viruses. Gravity pulls the water down through a series of buckets connected by tubes. The buckets contain sand with a layer of good bacteria on top, which eat the microbes that contain diseases like typhoid. The magnetic quality of the sand kills other bacteria as the water filters through it. The final bucket uses nanomaterials to filter out any remaining microbes. Dr. Hilonga was inspired by a visit to his parents' village outside Arusha in Tanzania, where many people with no access to clean water suffer from waterborne diseases.
In Tanzania, 70% of households, of 9 million households, are not using any kind of a filter. That is how big the market is. That is in Tanzania alone. 9 million households. Then imagine in Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, sub-Saharan Africa, India, and elsewhere. So the market is very big.
One filter costs about $140 and can supply many liters of clean water a day. The Blue Sky Primary School in Arusha uses it to quench the thirst of more than 70 children.
Well, we analyze the water around, and we have a river like 50 meters far from here, and we saw that it was not healthy, that water. Then we took water from the government supply, but we also saw that it was not going to be healthy, and we want the best things for our kids, so we decided to buy the filter.
Dr. Hilonga hopes the filter will one day be used to help communities and villages across Africa access clean water.
That was reporter Leonard Demudu. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Robert Lewis, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Somalia, long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, has made many strides since completing its political transition in 2012. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are now signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's deepening relationship with it, the U.S. mission to Somalia began operations on September 8th. It is based within the United States Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and will be headed by a chargé d'affaires until President Obama appoints and the Senate confirms the next U.S. ambassador. It's a critical step towards normalizing the U.S.-Somalia bilateral relationship, since our recognition of the federal government of Somalia on January 13th, as announced by Secretary of State John Kerry on May 5th during his historic visit to Mogadishu. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then-growing instability, the United States conducted diplomacy on Somalia affairs based out of Nairobi. Over the past 5 years, U.S. officials began to travel more frequently into Somalia to conduct official business. When security conditions permit, it is envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in Mogadishu. While Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists Al-Shabaab have been weakened but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and international partners, but for its leaders to put their loyalties and differences behind them and commit to working together for the common good.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Next on Let's Talk, nicknames. Do you like yours? Remember who gave it to you? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing nicknames. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening,
VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.